BBC World Service, this is Julian Marshall with NewsHour. Coming up in the next 60 minutes, Greek workers clash with police as they protest against planned deep cuts in government spending. Did the British oil company BP seek to downplay the risk of the massive oil slick now threatening the fishing industry in the southern United States?
I made a loan after Hurricane Katrina, and I asked for a leniency of 3 or 4 months on payment because I have no idea what's going to happen with this particular oil spill.
And claims of torture of prisoners by the Afghan intelligence service.
They attached these two wires, one on my left toe and one on my right toe. And then they turned round the handle and electrocuted us.
First, there we have our main stories in detail.
BBC News with Michael Poles. Strong winds and rough seas are frustrating efforts to contain a huge oil slick that's washing up in the southern United States. Oil is still gushing from the wreckage of the platform which sank after a huge explosion in the Gulf of Mexico 9 days ago. High seas are forecast for Sunday, raising fears that oil could be pushed deep into the wetlands of southeastern Louisiana and could reach three other states, Mississippi, Alabama and Florida, by Monday. The British oil company BP is facing criticism for its response to the disaster, but its spokesman Andrew Gowers said right now BP was focused on the cleanup, not on fault and blame.
This is the largest maritime mop-up operation that has ever been mounted, by far. We have 76 boats out there. We have 5 planes flying sorties over the Gulf and spraying dispersants on the spill. We have thousands of people working offshore and onshore now.
Greek police have used tear gas to disperse demonstrators outside the finance ministry in the capital, Athens. A prominent hotel was also vandalised during May Day rallies and strikes to protest against austerity measures planned by the Greek government. The Greek Prime Minister, George Papandreou, is expected to give details of the cuts on Sunday. Malcolm Brabant has this report from an incident on the streets of Athens.
I'm outside the University of Athens, where a Greek state television truck is on fire. Anarchists who were marching past saw that it was standing there, and it's a symbol of the state. And so they smashed the windows, and somebody put a petrol bomb inside and set it on fire. The fire brigade is now here and has put out the flames. The riot police have chased off the anarchists, and there's a terrible, searing taste of tear gas in the air.
Tens of thousands of Maoists are staging a demonstration in the Nepalese capital Kathmandu, demanding the resignation of the government. Demonstrators are poured into the capital from the countryside, as Joanna Jolly reports from Kathmandu.
In well-organised and disciplined groups, tens of thousands of Maoist supporters marched from 18 points around the city into a park in central Kathmandu. There was a heavy security presence with 15,000 police on standby, as the Maoists, many of them young men who had been bussed into the capital, walked through the streets. Despite fears of violence, so far the rally has been peaceful. The Maoists are demanding that the current coalition government resigns in favour of a government of national unity, led by them.
A bomb blast at a race course in Russia's North Caucasus region has killed one person and injured at least 20 others. The explosion happened in the VIP box during a race meeting held in the town of Nalchik to celebrate May the 1st, the Russian Festival of Spring and Labour. A former interior minister of the local area was present. There is no indication so far as to who might have been behind the blast. You're listening to the World News from the BBC. 2 explosions at a mosque in the Somali capital Mogadishu have killed at least 17 people attending midday prayers. A senior leader of the Al-Shabaab insurgent group linked to Al-Qaeda, Fawad Mohammed Khalif, was among some 50 people injured in the attacks. It's unclear if he was the intended target. The blasts were at a mosque in the bustling Bakara market area of Mogadishu, where Al-Shabaab has a strong presence. One person was killed in an explosion at a nearby mosque on Tuesday. Activists in South Korea have sent balloons carrying leaflets, DVDs and money into North Korea, despite warnings from the North not to do so. Relations between the two Koreas are under severe strain after the unexplained sinking of a South Korean warship in March. The leaflets contain the Universal Declaration of Human Rights and criticism of North Korea's communist government. Suzanne Scholte of the Defence Forum Foundation, the American organisation that hosted the event, said the balloons would help the North Korean people learn the truth about their country.
This is the final week of North Korea Freedom Week, which has been a week to promote the freedom, human rights, and dignity of the North Korean people. And today we're launching balloons to send messages of the truth to the North Korean people.
Police say a bomb has exploded at a busy market in northwest Pakistan, killing at least two people and wounding several others. The explosion happened in Mingora, the main city of the Swat Valley. The region was a Taliban stronghold until the Pakistani army last year brought it back under government control. Correspondents say sporadic bomb attacks in recent months have raised fears that the militants may be regrouping. With less than a week to go until a British general election, which is expected to be the most closely contested for decades, two leading national newspapers have abandoned their support for the governing Labour Party. The Times is urging its readers to vote for the Conservatives, while The Guardian says in an editorial that if it had a vote, it would be cast enthusiastically for the Liberal Democrats. And that's the latest BBC News.
You're listening to the BBC World Service. I'm Julian Marshall with NewsHour. May Day is being marked around the world, an international celebration of the social and political achievements of the labour movement. It's lost its ideological edge since the collapse of communism, but it remains a powerful focus for workers' grievances, and no more so than in Greece today, where thousands have taken to the streets of Athens and cities elsewhere in the country to protest against the public spending cuts the government is being forced to make to secure international loans to fend off bankruptcy. This was the sound as Greek police used tear gas to disperse demonstrators outside the finance ministry in the capital. Well, the government is still finalising details of the cuts with the International Monetary Fund and other Eurozone countries and is expected to make an announcement tomorrow. But they're expected to include reductions in wages and pensions and increases in taxes and the age of retirement. Let's hear first from the BBC's Malcolm Brabant in Athens, who's been with the protesters. And where are you now, Malcolm?
Well, I'm inside an arcade which is full of cafes, and I've just witnessed the most extraordinary scenes which show just how people feel about the Greek government. I'm very close to the university, and trouble started here with anarchists smashing up and setting fire to a satellite truck belonging to the Greek state broadcaster because it was a symbol of the state. And trouble ebbed and flowed. And then I was in this arcade trying to get away from some tear gas and some trouble. And suddenly, in comes a former government minister, a former president of parliament called Apostolos Kaklamanis. And he is absolutely heckled and surrounded by people who are just giving him the most extraordinary insults. And he has to take refuge in the toilet of a cafe. And suddenly the police are called and he needs to get protection to get out. And he was sheltering in there for about 15, 20, maybe half an hour because these people were just giving him such a hard time. And when I was talking to them, they were saying, the reason we hate these people is because, you know, this was a government that promised us so much. They have stolen our money in the past when they have taken loans, and now they're going to take more loans and they're going to steal our money. And they were saying that they have basically declared war on this government. And so this very elderly statesman of this particular party has got a real dose of how the people are feeling about the way that the government is having to carry out these measures.
So a lot of the protesters, Malcolm, clearly very, very angry, but the general mood in Greece, one of anger or some resignation as well?
Well, I think there is a sense of both in a way. I think there's an awful lot of anger that people feel as though they have been completely let down by the political establishment, and there is resentment that they are going to be forced to make austerity, to tighten their belts in order to be able to pay off these enormous amounts of debt. But for those people who are not so involved in the political scene, I think there is a sort of an awareness that there has to be a change. And for example, I was talking to some young actors yesterday who see this whole sort of change and this whole sort of crisis as almost a sense of catharsis for Greece, where it can cleanse all of the bad habits and clear itself up and look forward to a brighter future. But everybody here does feel as though you're going to have 10 bad years.
OK, Malcolm, many thanks. That was the BBC's Malcolm Brabant in Athens. So what is the Greek business community making of the forthcoming austerity measures? I'm joined live by Konstantin Mikolos, chairman of the Athens Chamber of Commerce and Industry. Now, are you philosophical enough to look upon this as a moment of catharsis for Greece?
Well, first of all, Mr. Marshall, good afternoon from Athens. Difficult day today as a result of the protests, which were expected, we have to say that. This austerity package that has already been announced by the government is pretty severe. We knew that the measures that needed to be taken were going to be painful. But on the other hand, we've got to take into account the fact that we've got a huge public sector. Often indicated that for a country of 10.5 million population, it is absolutely ridiculous to maintain 1.1 million public servants, and most of them are not productive at all, I would say. So there have to be austerity packages in order to reduce the size of the public sector. But on the other hand, we have to create the conditions, the necessary conditions, so that these people are drawn into the private sector. Unfortunately, these conditions haven't been laid out or outlined by the government, and this is the reason why we have been pressing over the last 4 or 5 months for growth measures, growth policies, because if we don't enhance growth into our economy in the coming months, then I fear the worst as far as social cohesion is concerned.
You talk about social cohesion. Is the government going to be able to implement these measures? We've seen something of the anger amongst Greeks on the streets of Athens today. Could the country become ungovernable?
Well, I wouldn't go to that extreme, but one thing is for sure, that the political and financial irregularity that has taken place since 1974, that was the date of the restoration of democracy in Greece following the military junta, is definitely coming to an end, as well as the family political orientation that we have here in Greece. It would suffice to say that over the last 30 years, 25 years have been ruled, we have been ruled by effectively two families in Greece. Now, I think that this political solution has come to an end, because no one will be prepared to contribute in this austerity package unless they see that their money is going for good cause, is going for the restoration of the Greek economy, both to the Greeks, but more so to our European partners, and obviously to the International Monetary Fund, who will be regulating this program in the coming months, if not in the coming 3 years. So it's a dead end for us, and we all have to realize that there's only one way ahead, and we can only proceed if we're certain that the money which is going to be pumped into the economy will go into the right place.
Very briefly, Mr. Mikolos, you're going to see a contraction, presumably, of the economy in Greece. Not good for business people.
Absolutely. The initial estimate by the government at the beginning of the year referred to a contraction of 0.3%. We didn't agree with that figure. Then the Bank of Greece came out a month ago and have indicated a recession of 2%. But all our estimates show that we're going to have a recession for 2010 nearing 4%. So it is a very difficult time. Consumption has shrinked. The austerity package will shrink consumption even more. And that's one more reason that I would like to repeat again. If we don't have the necessary levels of foreign investment, domestic investment, and enhancing growth policies, which we have all of these have been outlined to the government, then I fear the worst for 2011.
Okay, Mr. Mikolos, many thanks. Konstantin Mikolos, chairman of the Athens Chamber of Commerce and Industry. Strong winds and rough seas are frustrating efforts to contain a massive oil slick washing up on the coast of the southern United States, where it's threatening wildlife and livelihoods. The slick's being caused by oil which is still gushing out from a fractured pipe on the seabed beneath a platform which sank in the Gulf of Mexico 9 days ago. Documents are starting to emerge in which the British oil company BP suggested last year that it was unlikely or virtually impossible for an accident to occur. that would lead to a giant oil crude spill and cause serious damage to beaches, fish and mammals. But as of now, BP is being told by the Obama administration it must do more to tackle the leak and the spill. BP spokesman Andrew Gower says the company is doing all it can, even though it's not responsible for the original accident.
We're responsible for the oil leaking into the sea. We're not responsible for the original accident that took place on a rig owned and operated by another company, but we are fully taking responsibility for the consequences. The issue right now is that we are 150% focused on fighting it below the sea by stopping the well that's leaking. And that's a complicated technological challenge at 5,000 feet of water. We're concentrated on fighting it on in the offshore, containing it and preventing the slick from spreading. And we're focused on preventing it from reaching the shore, and as it does reach the shore, minimising and cleaning up the damage.
BP spokesman Andrew Gars. Well, so large now is that oil slick and increasing at the rate of 5,000 barrels a day until such time that the leak can be stopped, that it's visible from space and it's spreading and flowing remorselessly towards the environmentally sensitive coastline. The BBC's Matthew Price went out to meet some of those likely to be affected in Louisiana.
This is the Harbour Seafood and Oyster Bar at Cypress Cove. It's a very popular spot with the fishermen and others who work out of Venice, Louisiana. And normally at this time, on an evening, just as dusk is approaching, it shouldn't be this busy, but it is packed, as you can hear. And that is because none of these fishermen are putting out to sea at the moment.
First name is Owen Langridge. I'm a charter captain. My company name is Big O Charters.
How bleak is the picture at the moment?
We myself don't, and most of the men you see sitting here have no way to make any living right now other than taking people fishing. I actually called SBA, which is a Small Business Administration, today because I made a loan through them after Hurricane Katrina to get back on my feet, and I asked for a leniency of 3 or 4 months on payment because I have no idea what's going to happen with this particular oil spill. I have no idea if I'll have any income.
Did they give you that leniency?
Yes, they did.
Well, that's a relief at least.
Well, they're sending me the paperwork. And so anyway, that's where we all at. And you're looking at all these men right here. They're all in the same boat.
An interesting metaphor to choose, perhaps, but certainly an accurate one. Also here this evening is A.C. Cooper, the Vice President of the Louisiana Shrimp Fishermen's Association.
You look exhausted. Your eyes are red. I mean, what have the last few days been like?
It's been hectic. No sleep, worrying about what's going on, trying to get things together for these fishermen because we've got a lot of people at stake right here.
Do you think there was enough preparation for something like this?
No, that's one thing I met with some of the senators and reps today. Charlie Malone was here today. We want a plan. After seeing what we just seen, we are all producing state. We know we're going to have more. We want a plan from the federal government, we want a plan from the state, and we want a plan for the fishermen. If we have to head it up for the fishermen to where when something like this happens, we're the first deployed, that's what we have to do. Not after we done hit.
Well, down here by the docks, it's pretty quiet. There's hardly a boat going out. Simply an ominous wind that is blowing and has been now just about all day from offshore. It's a wind that is blowing the waves in this direction and therefore the oil.
Christopher Pulaski, Coastal Louisiana organizer with the National Wildlife Federation.
One of the national debates that has been prompted by this is for those opposed to offshore drilling to say, you see, you shouldn't drill offshore. I presume it's slightly more complex here because people's livelihoods depend not just on the environment and fishing, they depend on oil as well.
That's exactly right. We've it's very sensitive. This part of the country depends heavily on oil. It's one-third of the nation's oil production. So that balance is tough.
Do you find that the oil industry is more engaged in environmental issues now than perhaps it used to be?
I think so. I've seen and spoken with, you know, lots of the members of the industry just in my goings-on and with coastal restoration, and they do play a key role in that and have played an active part in that, not just with funding but also with response and participation in our coastal efforts.
Well, it's hard to assess standing here right now looking out to sea is how this is going to develop. Everyone I've spoken to here is convinced that this is a disaster in the making. It certainly could be. Oil is pouring from that pipe like water from a leaking hose, and so far no one has worked out how to stop it.
That was the BBC's Matthew Price in Louisiana. Well, those documents I referred to earlier were part of an exploration plan and environmental impact analysis that BP did last year for the Deepwater Horizon well, the one that's now causing all the problems. The analysis said that it was, and I quote, unlikely that an accidental surface or subsurface oil spill would occur, and even if it did, no significant adverse impacts are expected due to the distance from the shore and the response capabilities that would be implemented. Jeffrey Maitland is Professor of Energy and Engineering at Imperial College London. Professor Maitland, how could BP apparently have got it so wrong?
Well, I think one has to realise that the situation that's happened on this rig is a very rare event, and that there are a lot of safety procedures in place, nevertheless, to try and counter such an influx of gas that caused this explosion. And I think from their analysis, they were obviously satisfied that the hierarchy of safety procedures that were in place were adequate to cope with the most extreme situations.
Should blame attach solely to BP, or should we also be looking at Transocean, who operate the rig, and indeed Halliburton, who are the oil services contractor?
Well, I think in terms of apportionment of blame, obviously that's very premature, but in terms of the way that this rig was operated, the rig is indeed owned by Transocean, and they were the contractors that involved in the drilling operation. So it was their rig and their operations that were performing at the time of the accident. BP are the owners of the, or co-owners of the asset in the field, and therefore they take responsibility for the consequences of the accident as it's taken place, because they own the oil and gas that's being produced. Halliburton are the main contractors that provide a lot of the services that are on the rig, but they were not the ones that were operating the rig.
But they were the ones who, as I understand it, originally cemented the well. And according to a 2007 study by the US Federal Minerals Management Service, which examined 39 rig blowouts, cementing was a contributing factor in 18 of the incidents.
Yes. And again, any inquiry will show what were the contributing factors were, I think. The a weak cementing or imperfect cementing job can contribute to migration of gas to the surface. My feeling is that this was such a catastrophic failure that that's unlikely to be the sole cause. I mean, the major cause of this blowout was that the drilling had encountered a pocket of gas that was at a significantly higher pressure than the rest of the fluids in the zone that was being drilled into. And it's not unusual to encounter high-pressure regions when one gets a small release of gas called a kick. And the procedures that are in place to cope with those are very extensive and well-practiced. Those procedures should also be able to cope with larger influxes of gas, which is what I presume happened in the current situation, such that the rate and the pressure build-up were faster than normal. And obviously the response of the monitoring systems and the operations on the rig weren't able to cope with the extent of that gas release.
Professor, many thanks. Professor Jeffrey Maitland of Imperial College London. You're listening to the BBC World Service. I'm Julian Marshall with NewsHour. And coming up, we look at the run-up to next week's British general election, and everyone is happy with the new style of electioneering.
The whole political situation is like Big Brother, in the sense that whenever you see Big Brother on TV, they say, who wins? You decide. Who loses? You decide. Who stays? You decide. Who goes? You decide. But no matter how many times you vote right, you can never, ever do the one and only thing you would really, really want to do, which is vote off Big Brother itself. And it is exactly Big Brother that picks the pathetic candidates, none of whom deserve our vote. And it is Big Brother that sets them up in a house in which they constantly are forced to bicker about absolute trivia and nothing interesting ever happens. And somehow that is such a parallel to our house, to the House of Commons and all these candidates, where you go, there's no real choice. What I'd really like to do is for there to be an extra box on the ballot paper that says none of them. Close the place down. Let's start from scratch, from the absolute beginning. And that would be the same with Big Brother. We'd get rid of them as well.
More of that shortly, plus some more sober political analysis. Two people have been killed in a bomb attack in northwest Pakistan. Such attacks have become all too frequent as Taliban insurgents continue their fight against the state. But this latest attack occurred in Mingora, the main city in the Swat Valley, a former Taliban stronghold, which the government said it had brought back under its control after an offensive last year against the Taliban. The BBC's Harun Rashid has just returned from the Swat Valley.
The situation has improved considerably in that region, especially in the urban areas. There are lesser security checkposts on the road, lesser military presence on the streets, and return of some of the economic activity in the bazaars and marketplaces in Swat. But the problem is that people there still have fears. The fear that the Taliban leadership is still absconding, the military needs still to take care of them, and unless that happens, complete peace would not be possible, and incidents like today's suicide bombing may continue from time to time.
Of course, a certain amount of publicity attaches to a bomb attack in Mingora, but there have also been, haven't there, in recent months, targeted killings of local influential people?
Yes, of course, people there fear that since the Taliban leadership is still can manage to plan attacks, and that is the reason that they from time to time send in people to target personalities which are pro-military and pro-government and who want to work for peace in that region. So whoever is anti-Taliban, they have targeted them in the last 2 weeks. We were told that there were 7 such deaths, including 2 members of local peace committees. But the military says that they have complete hold over the valley, the urban areas, and the militants cannot stage a complete comeback. But they can be a problem from time to time, and they can still send in people for such target killings. But they have killed 3 insurgents while we were there. They had a clash with the militants, and they claim these 3 were behind the recent target killings. So they say that the intelligence is coming in, people are cooperating, and they hope that these attacks will be brought down and there will be not many such attacks in the future. But of course, they think that complete eradication of such attacks or stoppage of such attacks would take some more time.
I mean, why is the Taliban leadership in the Swat Valley still intact? I mean, why do they remain beyond, it would appear, the reaches of the Pakistani security forces?
Swat is a mountainous region, and its geographical location is quite convenient for the Taliban leadership. It is next to Bajor tribal region and the Afghan border. So whenever there is a push against them, it is quite easy for them to either move to these tribal regions where military is still trying to get hold of some of the areas. And if even the situation in the tribal region gets tough for them, they can always manage to sneak into Afghanistan for a brief period of time. And when they think that they can come back, they have always used that window of opportunities to return. So, I mean, in these mountainous regions, the insurgents militarily always have upper hand. The military is, although claiming that they have the urban areas, in the mountains they say that it will be very difficult for the militants to come back because they are keeping a complete check on the whole area.
The BBC's Harun Rashid. And a brief comment from a listener on that oil spillage. Most of those outside of the affected area who are complaining are self-righteous in the extreme. I bet most drive a car which needs oil. And where does that come from? Well, to have your say at bbc.com is our email address.
You can find out more about programmes coming soon on the new Coming Soon section of our website. Just go to bbcworldservice.com and click Coming Soon.
Coming up on NewsHour in the next 30 minutes, claims of torture by the Afghan intelligence service. The minister in charge of prisons tells us it's nothing to do with him. And who'll be running Britain after next week's election as opinion polls point to an inconclusive result. Now a summary of the latest world news.
BBC News with Michael Poles. Strong winds and rough seas are frustrating efforts to contain a huge oil slick that's washing up in the southern United States. Oil is still spewing out of the platform, which sank after a huge explosion in the Gulf of Mexico 9 days ago.